From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, some amazing scientific stories. We'll also talk about some time machines, but here's what's happening. Molten lava from a volcano in Hawaii is pushing closer to a rural area. It's closed the main road and triggering warnings that residents might need to leave their homes at any time. Dozens of people in the path of the flow were told to prepare for a possible evacuation. Now, no evacuations yet have been ordered. The Red Cross said it was opening up a shelter to aid any evacuees. Authorities say the lava flow on the Big Island of Hawaii, that's where we have a studio, had picked up speed, advancing 170 yards since 9 a.m., moving at the rate of about 15 to 20 yards an hour. That's a lot. An American nurse who has tested negative now for Ebola has been released after days in quarantine in New Jersey. Also, a five-year-old boy who recently visited West Africa and now has a fever was being tested for the virus in New York. And DNA programmed blotting paper could soon be used by doctors, giving a simple test that will reveal an infection in 30 minutes for just pennies. Researchers have proved the technique works by developing a prototype Ebola test in just 12 hours using $20 worth of materials. Let's check in with the author and researcher, Christian Wild, who can give us an update on the Ebola situation. Seems a little quiet this week, Christian. What do you think?
Well, thank God it does. It looks a little quiet here in the States, but it's going rampant in Africa. The deaths so far are 4,922 in West Africa, 2,705 in Liberia, 1,281 as of today in Sierra Leone, and 926 in Guyana. But here's the difference. In the United States, we marshal tremendous facilities and knowledgeable people in infectious control to attack any one of these cases. And as a result of that, these people are surviving. It's kind of amazing because we've only lost a handful of people compared to what they lose in West Africa. Those people don't have a prayer. They've only got 620 beds for the thousands of people in Guyana. In Liberia, there's only 620 beds. And in Sierra Leone, they reported they've got 346 beds for these thousands of people who are dying. So the health care they're getting is so minimal. It's almost embarrassing that people have to live that way. And here in the United States, so much effort is concentrated. And as a result of that concentration, these people are living. We didn't expect that to happen. We thought that you'd have the same results. Mm-hmm. 70% of the people would die.
Well, I know. We've been fortunate. But, Christian, I have to ask you this. We've only had a certain amount of beds available for these Ebola patients. If we had the same kind of epidemic like they have in West Africa, we'd be way up a creek right now.
We would be. But fortunately, George, it hasn't worked that way so far. The patients who have been surviving, the reason they're surviving is one reason is that they have been given antibodies from a patient who has already had the disease and has recovered. That's number one. Number two, and as I mentioned last week on my website, is that interview that anybody can still see of a doctor who was so desperate with his 15 dying patients of Ebola that he, as a last resort, injected them with an AIDS antiviral drug, which is very similar. The two diseases are similar. And 13 of those 15 are living. So on the good side of the coin, we are seeing people survive this illness. And if the people in Africa could have the health care and the antiviral drugs that we have available, think about it. But 30,000 people, George, die in this country from the flu.
Exactly.
And here we've lost, two or three people. Not that anyone wants to lose anyone, but those who have been injected with antiviral drugs and who receive the antibodies of another patient have survived. And yes, you mentioned beds in this country. The National Institutes of Health only have two beds. Two beds. And when they flew that patient there last week, they took one of those two beds.
We could not handle this kind of an epidemic that they're having in Africa, Christian, if that happens here. There's just no doubt about that. Track Christian's work, myheartbook.com. Strange story in Russia. Vladimir Putin may be suffering from cancer of the spine or pancreas. Now, I say strange because this seems to be one of those internet stories, but it's coming out of different kinds of internet reports. Now, despite the Russian president's macho image as an outdoorsman and martial artist, rumors of this nature have circulated before in several elements of the overseas media over the last few years. But the latest is in a gossip column in the New York Post, which claims that the illness may explain Putin's attitudes and very strange behavior. Does he have cancer? Who knows yet? In Paris, a wave of panic sparked by evil clowns stalking French towns has spread to the south of France, where police have now arrested 14 teenagers dressed as the pranksters, carrying pistols, knives, and baseball bats. Maybe now you know why I don't like clowns. In Michigan, police in Ottawa County there are looking for the driver who hit a Muskegon man Saturday night. What's so important about this? Well, the investigators say that 45-year-old Jeffrey Stiles was attending a Halloween party and decided to step outside to try to scare drivers with his zombie costume. While in the road, he was hit by a car. The driver of the car did not stop. I agree with the Pope on this one. He says the Big Bang doesn't contradict the intervention of a divine creator, but demands it. The Pope was addressing the Assembly of Pontifical Academy of Sciences at the Vatican, and he simply said, it's not the work of just chaos, it's the work of God. AR2192, that's that big sunspot. It's the biggest in nearly 25 years. It is still growing. It is now the size of 16 planet Earths. We've been lucky so far that we haven't been hit with an X-flare. Let's check in with astronomer Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Stephen, we really are lucky on this one so far.
Oh, yes, we are, George, and it's amazing. AR2192 continues to impress, and if people still have those solar eclipse glasses, where can you see it with the naked eye, George? Right about the 4 o'clock position if you look at the sun during the daytime. But this is interesting. So far, since October the 19th, we've gotten about 5 of these X-flares. One, of course, on the 27th today or yesterday, depending on your time zone, and X2, and a whole bunch of M-class flares. But, George, the thing about this sunspot, it's not over by any means. Once it goes around the limb, my prediction very simply is the next 2 days it simply disappears. Wait, folks, until, and we can't wait, till, George, about maybe November 9th or 10th, when this sunspot, my prediction is, will continue to grow and impress. And then guess what? We get to do the whole thing over again, and hopefully not into the kill shot, correct?
You got that right. Stephen, thank you so much. Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. A UFO, they say, the size of Earth was observed entering or exiting the sun this weekend, which is seen in a series of pictures taken by SOHO, stating that the latest report from UFO watchers, according to UFO Sites Daily, the pictures of the sun are checked daily by the website's monitor, and they saw this very strange picture. To me, it looks more like a flare coming out of the side of the sun, but who knows? Up next, fascism in America, the essential May Brussels. It's an incredible story, and also the covert war against rock. Alex Constantine back on Coast to Coast next. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Alex Constantine is an American author, investigative journalist, online editor of the Constantine Report. You should spend some time daily going to that report. His work focuses on world fascism, political corruption, organized crime. His books have provided the premise for several BBC documentaries. Back several years ago, he was a featured speaker before a standing room only crowd at the Congressional Black Caucus's annual Brain Trust Conference. In 2009, he hosted a program that aired on French television about opposition to the Vietnam War. One of his books explored the possibility that O.J. Simpson was framed for murder by the mob and the police, resulting in Simpson's 1994 arrest and trial. We're going to be talking with Alex about a lot of issues tonight on Coast to Coast. Alex, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Let me tell you something. Your website is probably one of the best I have seen in a long, long time. It's almost like a book. Once you open it up, you can't put it down.
Thank you. It's yeah, that's gratifying to hear, actually. It has over 9,000 entries, many of them dealing with political assassinations. And you can get on it and pretty much follow your notes with the index at the bottom of the homepage, and you'll be busy for months.
You know, Alex, on this program, we really dig in to find the truth. You know, some people will accuse us, you know, you're conspiracy theorists, you're doing this and that. I just want to get to the bottom of things that happen. It just seems to me, and this is since I was 13 years old during the JFK assassination, that everything we're told is not the case. It's not the truth. Have you found that out too?
Well, I wouldn't say everything. I mean, that we get a smattering of information, usually in the middle of the night, but very little leaks through, I found. And when I began a book called Virtual Government back in the mid-90s, I wanted to start with an explanation so that my information would go down a little bit easier with the reader. So I began to dig in the interactions of the CIA and the media, and discovered Operation Mockingbird. I did a search on the internet and found no mention of it anywhere. So I thought, you know, I'd better dig into this subject and then it'll be a little easier on my readers. So I started to explore Operation Mockingbird and discovered that there were thousands of journalists around the world who were working for the CIA. That way back in 1977, there was a researcher by the name of Sean Gervasi, who found that one-third, he did an audit of the CIA's books and discovered that one-third of their budget was devoted to propaganda. So you have an American electorate now who's obsessed with sports and belly button pop music, really, really doesn't pay attention too much to politics, deep politics. And so they're pretty much distracted, and the media really don't help much because they keep it very superficial.
Now, when you got involved in looking at organized crime, political assassinations, coups, the CIA, how did you do that? I mean, what was that catalyst for you that made you jump into this?
Well, I started out your stereotypical nattering academic nabob and moved to Los Angeles in the early 1980s, hoping to make a career out of writing plays and short stories and novels.
Yeah.
But I had edited a newspaper in central Ohio and had done some investigative work and started to get the itch to do some more. So I found out about a trial in San Francisco that involved a cult who had murdered a homeless guy, tortured him to death all night, cannibalized parts of his body. And there were members of this cult who had ties across the bay to wealthy corporations and individuals and the CIA, and I began to ask a lot of questions about this stuff. So I went up and attended the trial, and one of the central participants in this murder had a swastika tattooed on his face. He'd escaped a Canadian prison, joined this cult operation. And I had a lot of questions about that murder, but I wrote up a short article for the LA Weekly and then spent the next month or so just following out the leads, and I ran up a phone bill about $500 a month, just calling police departments around the country and gathering information on cults. And pretty much I discovered that the CIA kept recurring in these stories. And so I began to look into CIA mind control and started to foray into organized crime because there were mafia connections, and found that there were judges involved in this stuff and lots of prominent people. And after about 6 months of this, I was totally obsessed. And then I turned on the radio one day and heard Mae Brussel on the air discovering some of the same cases that I was writing about at the time. So I, to lay a foundation for meeting her, I contacted some cult victims in San Francisco and had them get in touch with her. And she was excited to hear from them and interviewed them and got their accounts down on videotape. And I kept listening and ordered her information, sent her information. And the next thing you knew, she had cancer and she was dead. And I was totally devastated because the only person on earth who seemed to be on the same track that I was on was suddenly dead. So I ran up to Monterey where her show broadcast and talked to the producer, and he put me on the air. And before I knew it, I was in the same time slot doing the same sort of work, trying to pick up where she had left off. But, of course, she had much more experience than I did. But that was 26 years ago, and I've been doing it ever since.
That's right. And there's some people who may not know who she was, Alex. She was a local broadcaster in the Los Angeles area.
Right.
Southern California. She, you know, died at the age of 66, as you say, cancer. And she was heavily into the assassination of President Kennedy, the history of fascism. I wonder what got her going.
It was a Kennedy assassination. She was watching the tube one day, ironing her clothes, her family's clothes, and watching TV. And she happened to catch Jack Ruby shooting Lee Harvey Oswald, and the whole thing looked a little fishy to her. And she began to look into the Kennedy assassination, ordered all 26 volumes of the Warren Commission report, began to pull names out of it, cross-reference the names, and ended up with 26,000 pages of notes cross-referencing all the information in the Warren Commission report. And she did that for 6 or 7 years before she ever went public with her findings. In fact, she broke out really when Watergate occurred. She saw the notice in the Washington Post because she'd been following the press and doing open source research at the time. And she caught the names of several Cubans who were involved in the Watergate break-in and recognized the names from the Kennedy assassination. The Cubans hailed from a group called Operation 40, which was Richard Nixon's black bag and assassinations team, and you never really even heard of it until the Church Committee came along.
Well, that's
but
true.
You never heard about the assassinations for various reasons that I write about in my next book. But she recognized the names and started to cross-reference Watergate and ended up with a massive article that she published in The Realist. Paul Krasner published that publication, and John Lennon financed it. He threw in $5,000 for the publication of May's article, and she had an ongoing association with Lennon. As a matter of fact, shortly before his death, she spent a week with him, and this isn't really public knowledge, but I really suspect that that's one of the reasons that he was assassinated, with some of the information that he picked up from Mae Brussel.
Interesting. And, you know, she was doing this way before Jim Garrison got involved, wasn't she?
Yeah, she recognized a coup when she saw it, and she was treading on eggshells at the time because, you know, she didn't have any backup. She had no support. She was just a stereotypical housewife who happened to start putting information together and following out the leads. And when I say that she was pulling names out of the Warren Commission, every one of the names that she pulled out around Lee Harvey Oswald trailed off to the Third Reich. And it didn't, you know, the work is really easy when you start making associations like that and let the facts speak for themselves, and that's what she did.
You know, Alex, when you got involved in this, and you've touched many areas that really, I think, are the pulse of America and what's wrong with us as a nation, this wonderful country, this country that we would, you know, die for, but it's got these people within it who are just so manipulative and so greedy. I mean, can we ever win based on the things we're going to talk with you about tonight? You look at it and you go, oh, my God.
Well, what are we up against here?
Exactly.
I'm interested in fascism beginning with its inception in the 1920s, and it, as I see it, it comes about as a result of the rise of the robber barons in the 19th and early 20th century. You have a number of corporations, in fact, over 2,000 of them, including AT&T, Standard Oil, General Electric, IBM, Kodak. There was a corporation called American Cyanamide, now known as Home Products, General Motors, DuPont, Ford, Monsanto, Hugo Boss, Coca-Cola, Chase Bank, Sullivan and Cromwell, on and on, the Hearst Press, Brown Brothers, Harriman, and so forth, all doing business with the Nazis before World War II, and many of them continued to do business during the war and to profit from it. Why? Because corporations tend to enhance the bottom line, and they don't care how they get there, right?
True.
The leading bridge to Nazi Germany was Monsanto.
Hold on for a second, Alex. Hold on. We'll come right back with you. Fascinating subject. Alex Constantine with us for a couple hours here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Pacific time for you Coast Insiders, we will have our pre-Halloween chat. That's right. We normally have it on the second Tuesday of the month, but I wanted to move it down so we could have some fun and talk about clowns and things like that. And welcome back to Coast, Alex Constantine with us. His website linked up there at coasttocoastam.com. It's constantinereport.com. Alex, we were talking about, of course, big corporations, of course, getting in bed with some governments. And they really, were they allowed to get away with it during the war? Did anybody try to stop them?
Yeah, there was a Dye Committee. There were some small congressional committees that looked into it and exercised a lot of rage over it, but never really got too far with it because, as Mussolini defined fascism, it's unbridled corporatism. And in Italian, that word has a word that's slightly, that's not quite what we mean by corporatism, but it comes down to the same thing. A lot of those corporations that I named were spin-offs of the Rockefeller and Morgan syndicates. And they're still around today, and they're still very influential, and they're making money on manufactured wars. We saw it with Bell Helicopter during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. At the time, headed up by a Nazi by the name of Walter Dornberger, who had committed war crimes for the Third Reich. The British wanted to hang him, but we brought him in to run Bell Helicopter. And as I mentioned, that's just one of the many names that turns up in the Warren Commission report. Because there was a character by the name of Michael Payne who sponsored Lee Harvey Oswald down in Dallas, worked for Bell Helicopter, had been a third-generation physicist for Harvard, and why he would have an interest in someone like Lee Harvey Oswald is hard to explain, but you put together the circle around Oswald and it begins to make a lot of sense, comes back to the same corporations, and some of the central participants, and we have the leadership that we have in the United States is generally determined by these same corporations.
And, you know, as I always say, Alex, there are no coincidences. So when you look at all these episodes, and I think Mae Brussel was absolutely right when she saw Jack Ruby shoot Lee Harvey Oswald. I mean, just the whole series of events was just too bizarre.
You know, I was thinking that May's work has never really been aired in a public forum of any appreciable scale. And in that sense, this conversation is pretty much historical because these corporations control the media. They have since the early 20th century. And it used to be direct corporate control of the propaganda, but in 1947, that was turned over to the CIA. So the taxpayers are pretty much paying for their own perception management, and that's what we're fighting here.
What did May perceive with the JFK assassination? Did she come up with her own conclusions?
I think that she was completely objective about it. She was one of the most intuitive people who ever investigated the Kennedy assassination. I think she really wanted to get to the truth, and I've never found her stretching, exaggerating anything. She was a solid individual. She used to say that it takes steel to fight steel, and that's what she was. She was steel. And she began to look into, like I said, the circle around Oswald, particularly the Paynes, who I mentioned, and a guy by the name of George de Morenshield, who, according to FBI files, had been a Nazi spy during World War II. He worked in the oil industry, had ties to the Buckley and Bush families. As a matter of fact, his nephew roomed with George H.W. Bush at Phillips Andover. After he committed, quote, suicide in 1977, his wife Jean told the press that he was a Nazi spy. Richard Helms said that he was a Nazi spy. So you begin to see the word Nazi turn up over and over again in the Kennedy assassination. You can throw out all the books that blame Castro. Last year, I heard an interview with a New York Times reporter who went on and on about Castro behind the assassination. It's just a lot of baloney. And you have Mockingbird to thank for that because our perceptions are managed. And she wouldn't allow that to happen to her.
Would you say now, without a lot of people even knowing it, we are in a fascist state?
Yeah, definitely. And it's I think we're on the brink of open fascist rule. They're, you know, they're just about ready to admit it. I've had conversations with ranking Republicans who, you know, had no problem aligning themselves with that ideology in private conversations. You just look at what they're doing and make comparisons with Nazi Germany, and it's I think that the similarities are stark.
Alex, paint a picture for us. Let's assume for a moment that that does happen, and there's a complete shift from what we think is a democracy to fascism. What happens?
Well, let's just grab one cultural artifact out of the bag, and that's television. It's a little known fact that the Nazis had broadband, right? They had television with news trucks running around, and they had exercise programs and talk shows and all the rest.
That's right. They had a Department of Propaganda, didn't they?
Exactly. And you compare their television to present-day television, and you can see the similarities, but you don't hear much about that. As a matter of fact, I've had two Nazi TV shows on my website, and they both disappeared without explanation.
Huh.
So it's hard to keep them up there, but you can see the similarities. You go back, you know, some of the rhetoric, the manipulations, the many assassinations that May talked about. 300 assassinations as the Nazis rose to power. We see it here. Beginning, you know, in broad daylight in the public square in Dallas in 1963, you have look closely at the assassination of John Lennon. When Chapman went to court, the judge assigned three psychiatrists to take a look at him. All three came out of MK Ultra. One was a major mind control operative. He used to boast about creating a Manchurian candidate in 6 months. He said he could create a hypnotically driven patsy in 3 months.
Jeez.
His name was Dr. Milton Klein. He was co-founder of the Society for Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis. He had credentials that went on and on. But during the trial, it turned out that he was really a mister, not a doctor, because his bona fides were invented.
One of those I went to college and got a degree guys, right?
Exactly. It turned out that he had a master's degree in psychology, and that was about it. So he actually went to prison for 6 months for perjury. And there were two other psychiatrists who analyzed Mark David Chapman, and both of them were MK Ultra for mind control experimentation that the CIA had done in the 1950s. And I'm telling you, you don't hear much about mind control. But when I began to dig into it, I realized what a vast subject it is. You can go on for the rest of your life researching this subject and just only scrape the surface.
Alex, do you think that Mark David Chapman was mind manipulated?
Oh, I have no doubt about it. In fact, there's Dr. Dorothy Lewis at Yale. She's a professor in psychiatric research in the School of Medicine. And she wrote about Chapman's command hallucinations and wanted to know why no reputable psychiatrist involved in the case had raised the possibility of mind control, because the guy was hearing voices, which is one of the keys that you're looking for. And you notice how the media keep hammering away at that again and again.
Yeah.
Anybody who hears voices has got to be crazy. Well, that's how command hallucinations are done. And so you don't want to dismiss it out of hand and laugh it away, because a lot of these killings, you may remember the postal killings, right? Going postal.
That's right.
Right? Well, that's right. It suddenly stopped, right? And it was attributed to stress. And these postal killings were just, you know, postal workers who were working too hard, you know.
Mm-hmm. And now they've moved into the schools.
Right, and having family problems. And suddenly it stopped, and then it picked up in the schools. And when that happened, in that phase in between, I noticed that a lot of the mind control operatives in California were moving to Colorado. And I contacted a newspaper out there and told them this was happening. And they actually had some interest in it, but never pursued it, because the press just didn't do that. They're very authoritarian. And the next thing I knew was Columbine. So saw it coming, had tried to notify the press about it, but no one would move on it.
Under a fascist state, do we feel as if we're free?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of flag waving. You know, there's the message over and over again that this is a democracy, which it is not. When the CIA brought all those Nazi scientists over at the end of the war in the Pentagon, that wasn't done by election. We didn't vote for that. That was done blatantly under our nose.
Right. And we split them up with the Soviets, the Project Paperclip, I think.
Well, they hung a lot of them, but you know, what we did is falsified the records so that they would seem to be innocent. We brought, I don't know, you know what, a couple thousand Nazis over here. You may have caught the AP story last week. It was the longest AP report I have ever seen about how members of the Death's Head Order, the Waffen-SS, came to the United States and were receiving Social Security payments. And then Social Security caught on and wanted to expel them from the country, but the Justice Department made deals with them, and they went. One of them had been a guard at Auschwitz, for instance.
Oh my
God. He goes back to his native Croatia and continues to receive Social Security from the United States.
Unbelievable. Truly bizarre.
Isn't it?
Jeez. Now, we did get Wernher von Braun under that deal, though, and he was the father of our rocketry program, wasn't he?
That's right. He'd been involved in freezing experiments, you know, with Jews in Nazi Germany. Alan Dulles, who was really a central part of the Kennedy assassination and a lot of this turmoil, was sent over to Bern, Switzerland in 1942. So, and 2 years before the end of the war, his assignment was to compile dossiers on Nazi scientists for recruitment by the Pentagon, and that begins at the very end of the war. Just as the war is ending, the CIC, the Counterintelligence Corps, is brought in to recruit Nazi scientists, and Henry Kissinger also was a part of that.
They knew who they wanted to get and grab and bring here, didn't they? Immediately.
Exactly. And that's Alan Dulles. So now at the end of the war, there's a young attorney by the name of Richard Nixon, who's a naval intelligence, and he receives an assignment to start investigating Nazis for prosecution. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So he starts compiling his dossiers, and Alan Dulles comes along and says, listen, you just leave these Nazis alone, because these are our Nazis, and if you do that for us, we'll see that you make it to Congress.
Yeah, you can have your Nazis, and these are our Nazis.
That's right. So that's how Richard Nixon began his political career, covering up Nazi war crimes.
Now let's talk a little bit about your earlier work, The Covert War Against Rock. This fascinates me too, Alex, because
right.
it's all tied in together. But, you know, during the rock and roll era, Hoover, for example, hated these people, hated them. Was there a plan to do them all in?
I think that what happened was an evolution of something called Operation Chaos, which began as a surveillance program way back in 1962. It didn't have that name. It began with various sub-agencies of the CIA, who eventually came together around about 1967 under Lyndon Johnson, and they continued to do surveillance primarily until Nixon comes to power, and that's when you see the massive deaths among political musicians, right, in the United States.
That's right.
This goes on to the present day. I just finished doing some updating on the murder of Michael Hutchence, and you want a hair-raising story. That is it. And it involves the Calabrese Mafia, which was in league with the CIA over in Australia, where together they set up a bank called Nugan Hand, which you may have heard of, which was where the CIA was laundering its heroin proceeds at the end of the Vietnam War. And the Calabrese Mafia was heavily into the manufacture of meth in Australia after the bank went under. And the two heads of the bank committed suicide, supposedly. The Mafia was involved in the death of Michael Hutchence, and I lay that out in very clear terms. Now, I mentioned Nugan Hand Bank. It was established by a man by the name of Sir Peter Abels, who was Rupert Murdoch's business partner over in Australia at the time. So, you know, you see these guys, Murdoch's job over there was to cover up Nugan Hand activities of the Calabrese Mafia, which was in league with the CIA in Australia, and various political assassinations. And you see his Rupert Murdoch's modus operandi, because usually the cover story would have some seamy reference to some, you know, the sexual voracious
something like that,
so
yeah.
forth of the victim. So now you have a man who's murdered, tied to a doorknob, and he's naked. Well, that's because he was taking a bath when he was interrupted, and he was murdered. He was, you know, strangled, and then he was tied to a doorknob. And Rupert Murdoch comes along, hammering away at this sexual asphyxiation angle, which never really even occurred. Michael Hutchins, when he died, didn't have a dime to his name because it was all stolen by the Calabrese Mafia.
And he died on November 22nd.
Yeah, November 22nd. These dates are important because, I wondered why they do this, and I think I understand it now. It's a message to others who are involved in this stuff, right, that this is an inside job, you know.
No coincidence. Keep your mouth shut, or you're next.
Exactly.
Right?
You have 9/11 too, which occurred on the day of the overthrow of Salvador Allende, September 11th, 1973. We have our own 9/11, and pretty much parallels the progress taken after the coup down in Chile, which ended with thousands dead because the CIA gave the military down there the names of leftists to murder. And I'll tell you, there were so many murders down there that the Santiago River was dammed up with headless bodies.
And by the way, while we're talking, I got in one of my urgent emails popped in from one of our listeners. I've got a little segment on my computer that pops up like this.
Okay.
And his name's Charles Lewis, and he says, "Oh, my God, please tell your guest that I knew May." I don't know who May is. Is that a relative of yours or anybody?
That's May Brussels.
Oh, okay. All right. That May.
All right.
Okay. Well, he said, May and I were friends. We were neighbors. Please pass this on to Alex as soon as you can. I knew her daughter, Barbara. Yeah, went on and on. He even knew the owner of the KLRB radio station at the time. That May.
Okay. Yeah.
Small world.
That's right. She brought.
So anyways, I've passed the information on to you.
Okay, well, thank you. Where were we? I think anybody should feel honored to have known her and to have learned from her.
Well, these plots, like Michael Hutchins, his death on November 22nd, the message, you know, he was in the Ritz-Carlton in, I think, Sydney, Australia, if that's where he died, I think.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and he was a world-class rock musician. I mean, his stature was growing by leaps and bounds. Why would they want him done in? What was he doing?
Because he was number one a leftist, which puts you right on the list. But he was also agitating over the murders in East Timor, and at the time, the fact that there was American involvement in that was kept classified. And he wanted to put together a documentary on the subject, so next thing you knew, he was dead.
And dead indeed.
But he had been targeted for some of his statements, and as I say, he had been ripped off royally. $30 million disappeared, and it was taken by a network of trusts identical to the trusts that were set up by Nugent Hand. So that's no coincidence. But he thought he owned a bowling alley, for instance, and it turns out that bowling alley was being used to process heroin for distribution throughout Europe.
Jeez.
By the mafia. And he
had no idea
this was going on. He owned that bowling alley on paper, but it was taken away from him by his accountant, who was in league with the Calabrese Mafia.
Alex, if people want information on what you do, of course, your website and your books are available where?
Right. You can go to the Constantine Report, and if you look at the top of the homepage, you'll see excerpts from some of the books, and I have a couple of them on sale, very cheap, because I want researchers who don't have the resources to get a hold of the information.
All right, we're going to come back another hour to go, Alex. We'll take some calls, and I want to get your take on Edward Snowden, the whistleblower, when we come back.